Hello and welcome to another episode of the Shock Doctors Podcast. I'm Jim Smith.
I'm Matt Gerandaisi.
And they say things will be great when you're downtown.
That's true.
So I've been told.
That's the word on the street.
That is a paraphrasing of what I guess I would call the anthem of the subject of today's podcast, which is Last Night in Soho. Mm-hmm. It features rather prominently in the trailer and also in, I guess, what I might characterize as the mid-film climax.
Centerpiece, you might say.
Such as it is, yeah.
Yeah, that song has been running through my head the last 48 hours or so as we've been gearing up to review this flick. It's used rather memorably, I thought, in the trailer, kind of an eerie a cappella version of it, and it's put to good use in the film itself too. It's Edgar Wright. There are plenty of good needle drops, but on the basis of the film itself, I don't think that song is going to linger, earworm though it may be. I think I'm gonna have it out of my head in no time. It's still rattling around in there, but once the mics go off, its shelf life will be limited, I expect.
Yeah, I think so.
Did not like this movie half as much as I wanted to, and I think you liked it even less than that, not to, as we say, put the cart before the other thing. So it's about a girl, an art student, fashion student, actually, who is a recent transplant to, you guessed it, Soho, and she starts hopping between the present and the mid to late 1960s. In the same
swinging
burg.
60s.
Yes,
they...
decidedly. Yes. Big ol' Thunderball marquee. You've seen all this in the trailer. The glitz, the glamour, the nice coats. It's all very... It made me want to watch 101 Dalmatians again. You know? It's all very hip. And it's glamorous at first, and then it takes a turn for the sinister, and she finds herself inhabiting the body of a woman who is perhaps in peril. Definitely in some manner of peril. We open in not Soho, but in the country. What is the woman's name, main girl?
Ellie. Eloise.
Ellie has just received word that she's been accepted to this prestigious fashion academy, which is a very giallo premise just right off the bat. This is not a front for a coven, somewhat disappointingly.
It's just an art school.
And she's having hallucinations of, it's a ghost mom situation. She's seeing her mother's face, well, her mother's everything in the mirror in place of her own reflection and talking to it. And,
well, no, her mom, she sees,
oh, yeah, it
standing
doesn't,
behind
yes,
her.
Yes, it doesn't supplant her. That's a
supplanting
crucial
is
clarification.
Later.
Yes. I stand corrected. In any case, she credits Ghost Mom with some kind of gift of foresight because she expects... The mom gives her like a reassuring smile and a little nod when she asks, "It's good news, isn't it?" She says everything like that because she's mousy beyond all reason. It's like,
yes.
There's moments in this movie where her timidity is such that shrinking Violet doesn't even begin to cover it. And, you know, she comes into her own a little bit in the course of body jacking Anna Taylor-Joy, as anyone would. So she goes off to this prestigious fashion school and meets her roommate, who's a bit of a diva, a bit of a mean girl. And
A bit,
yeah.
It's like they took Rachel McAdams in Mean Girls and, like, compressed her down to the white-hot center of a dwarf star.
Yeah, right. It's like they took Rachel McAdams and dropped her into a vat of radioactive acid. Yeah, no, she's...
And her name is Jocasta, which is just heinous.
And she's dropped her surname because she thinks that just Jocasta is classier and is going to help her launch her fashion line. Sort of a Madonna thing, I guess.
Yeah, she thinks she's a mononym all of a sudden.
It's only a matter of time before she becomes a symbol. You know, the artist formerly known as Jocasta, Thompson or whatever the hell. So Ellie quickly finds herself sexiled and just generally exiled and is almost late to class because she's not sleeping well on her first day. She winds up crashing in the corner of this party, and there's
like
a little
student lounge of some kind.
And there's a little meet cute with her and this other dude whose name escapes me, who's
John,
the only guy who takes any interest in her.
We don't learn his name until like a while later, so you can be forgiven for not remembering it.
Yeah, well, he's sort of a non-character anyway.
Also true.
But yeah, she rebuffs all of his advances, such as they are. He's also very timid for most of the first leg of the movie, if not the entire first leg. So she moves out. It's not her scene. She finds a bedsit elsewhere in Soho. This slightly run down, used to be happening sort of pad, and the decor hasn't been changed much in the last 40 odd years, which suits her just fine. She's got a little bit of a hang up. Again, a little bit. She's got a major hang up with the swinging 60s and her grand's old records. She lived with her grandmother before she moved out to the big city, and there's a lot of warnings along the lines of it was like I was watching a silent film or something. It was like watching Murnau's Sunrise. Like, oh, the big city. they're gonna get you. it's like what year is this? Even in the 1960s, that attitude would have been pretty provincial.
Well, I mean, part of it too is that apparently her mom moved to the city and it overwhelmed her and she died. We intuit much sooner than we're told, but we find out definitively later that she committed suicide.
Yes, and she had mental health problems, which have evidently been passed on to her next of kin, because we've got a ghost mom situation on our hands. And
that soon becomes the least of it.
Yes, it in fact completely falls by the wayside, which is puzzling, but more on that later, I'm sure. Well, and this is known to the grandmother, too, that her granddaughter has seen these visions in the past, and she now insists that she no longer has them, which is not true. So she gets settled into this bedsit, goes to sleep, and then without much fanfare, I don't know, I wasn't expecting her to, like, get in a DeLorean or anything, but she gets under the covers. Well, okay, so first of all, checking all our giallo boxes.
Red neon.
Yeah, well, red, blue, and white neon, just to, oh, I get it, like the Cornetto trilogy. I only just figured that out.
Oh, fuck. Fucking. Well, it's a French bistro. I just thought the French flag.
Right, but probably okay, not coincidentally. Sure.
There you go.
Or, I don't know, maybe it's a fucking homage to the Kieslowski trilogy, but I kind of doubt it. So, yeah, no, there's a neon sign out of her window. They live above a French bistro, and it flashes alternately blue, white, and red. Although, it appears to go on the fritz semi-regularly and flash mostly red, because it's a horror movie. So she goes to bed. Neon lights are flashing. She gets under the covers and then emerges from an alleyway onto a busy street circa 1960 something or other. Again, we get Sean Connery's handsome mug up on the poster, big ol' glitzy marquee, Thunderball. And she goes into a swanky club. May I take your coat, miss? Looks in the mirror. It's
Anya
Taylor-Joy. I think I called her Anna earlier. Anya Taylor-Joy. And there's a little bit of monkey see, monkey do in the mirror. I liked the way that this was presented at first, and for much of the movie, because it's not your standard Freaky Friday, Quantum Leap kind of thing, where it's a one-to-one. She frequently gets left behind. Like, yes. Anya Taylor-Joy will walk off, leaving her reflection behind, and her reflection is Ellie. And, you know, sometimes Ellie will be sitting in the audience and watching Sandy, that's the girl's name, watching Sandy perform on stage, where she's sort of peripheral. And that was a neat variation on... I wasn't expecting this movie to rethink the trope all that much, and I want to get all the plaudits out of my system while the getting's good, because after the break, I'm going to, I think, be pretty sour.
Yeah.
So our first night in Soho, I guess you could call it, consists mainly of Sandy schmoozing and being this kind of eye-catching up-and-comer, this would-be it girl. And she lays eyes on this dude, Jack, played by Matt Smith. He lays eyes on her in a big way, and the two of them hit it off. He's going to help her career take flight, and he's fairly charming. He decks a dude who calls her a whore or a hussy or something, and the two of them hit the dance floor, not in that order, come to think of it.
Yeah.
And when they're on the dance floor, we get a lot of Matt Smith, the human window wiper, where the camera's swinging around him, and it's Ellie, it's Sandy, it's Ellie, it's Sandy, and that overstays its welcome, but it is flashy, and Edgar Wright has a certain verve, you know, when it comes to those kinds of set piece special effects moments. I don't know, this first 60s vignette is probably the highlight of the movie for me. It does have a certain intoxicating quality.
Yeah.
So other than Matt Smith, human windshield wiper, I like this sequence a fair deal. More than a little bit, let's say. Ellie wakes up the next morning and she's got a hickey. Her catty former roommate points this out to her. She has another interaction with the guy, John, was that it?
Yeah.
And these are peppered throughout the first half of the movie. But she rebuffs him yet again in favor of going back to her place alone and going to sleep and drifting off to her 60s dreamland.
I have a date with Matt Smith.
Mm-hmm. He's so dreamy. And
until he isn't.
Yeah, right. And you can see this coming from a mile away. I wish that they had given Matt Smith more to do after the heel turn, because when he's charming,
he has virtually nothing to do.
When he's turning on the charm, there's a little bit of nuance there, and then after he turns out to be a snake, it's one note to the point where, like, he basically just says one line for the rest of the movie. Literally one line.
Yeah.
That he says over and over again, which is a damn shame. Not like I want there to be shades. If he's just a bastard, he's just a bastard. You know, I'm not asking for, like, shades of gray in a moral sense, but for God's sake, let him play more notes on his instrument. You know, it's just a drag.
Yeah. Yeah.
So Ellie bears witness to Sandy auditioning for Matt Smith, whose name is Jack, right?
Yes.
Jack and some other guy, some other bigwig.
Presumably the owner of the venue they've dropped by.
And she sings a haunting a cappella version of Downtown.
It is the one from the trailer.
Mm-hmm. Back in the present day, Ellie gets her hair did. She dyes it blonde and is trying
styled the same way.
Yeah, right. Is in class designing a dress that is reminiscent, highly reminiscent, basically an exact duplicate of the dress that Sandy wore in the first flashback, Quantum Leap, whatever you want to call it. So she's still completely smitten, needless to say. Once or twice now, in addition to the John scenes, we also get occasional scenes of a sinister stranger played by Terrence Stamp. And he will just sort of ogle Ellie from a distance. She gets a job working in this bar in order to pay for rent now that she's not in student housing.
Well, maybe pay for rent, but the immediate trigger is she buys a bunch of vintage clothes. And
right.
Then she's like, oh shit, that's 375 pounds I don't have.
Right.
Better go become a barmaid.
You're right. I think that is the more immediate catalyst. Her landlady, by the way, who we've yet to touch on, is this kind of colorful old curmudgeon who doesn't like men in the apartment, and that's her defining characteristic for the bulk of the movie. But
no gentleman callers after 8.
Uh-huh. Next flashback vignette, we see that Sandy is not the new headliner, but is in fact a mute backup dancer in very skimpy attire, strutting around on stage for clapping and catcalls and wolf whistles. And this is the moment where everything goes to hell, and it goes to hell very precipitously, which I liked. I mean, I liked that kind of dizzy descent and that it wasn't a long, drawn-out revelation, mm-hmm. You know? It turns into, like, Mario Bava's Requiem for a Dream for a minute.
Yes.
Where, well, first, you see Matt Smith, first of all, being chummy with, I think, the guy that he decked on the dance floor. So,
yeah,
okay, he's not a knight in shining armor after all.
I might have imagined this part, but it almost looks like Matt Smith slips the guy money. Like,
uh-huh.
They set up the whole fight just to...
It could have been a bit of theater on their part, or it could have been that he's just a smooth operator and he was making nice and he has no scruples.
I'm fairly confident that we're meant to assume it was all theater.
Unfortunately, I agree with you, although I like that explanation less than him just being this glad-handing kind of, like, how can I make this go away kind of shit heel.
Right.
But as I said, he turns into such a cardboard cutout after this point in the movie that if he could have done one of two things, he probably did the more villainous of the two.
Yeah.
The more conniving, the more Svengali-esque of the two. The more elaborately villainous of the two. So we get this. Ellie finds herself in a hooker junkie House of Mirrors, where she's running through a hallway backstage past a bunch of green rooms and, you know, dressing rooms where women are giving depressing blowjobs and shooting up and
or having OD
and, yeah, and ODing and all manner of horrid things.
Matt Smith is chasing her down the hallway,
reciting his mantra, which is, "Where do you think you're going?
This is what you wanted."
Yeah, right. Okay, so he has two lines. Well, mea culpa.
He has a third line. It's something to the effect of, "Where are you going to go?" or "What do you think you're going to do?" or something
like
that.
"Yeah, where do you think you're going?" Right, exactly. It's all variations on a theme.
But yeah, those are his three lines. And it's predominantly, "Where do you think you're going?" and "This is what you wanted."
Right. So Sandy, in the past, descends into prostitution, and Ellie is along for that ride to a certain extent. Her dream has become a nightmare. She wakes up. She becomes fixated on the idea that Terrence Stamp, the leering elderly gentleman in the present, is grown-up, wizened old Matt Smith, and there's a good shot of Terrence Stamp slinking off into the night as one of her bar co-workers describes him as an octopus. It was just like the body language. You know, he's not actually waving his arms from side to side, but you feel it spiritually. He's got tendrils, you know. That was rather good. Well observed. And Terrence Stamp and Matt Smith do a good job. Well, Matt Smith in the first half of the movie when he's actually permitted to do things. The two of them do a good job of emulating one another's mannerisms without it being really
camp.
Yeah, right. Really on the. It's not like when you look at Matt Smith, he's doing an impression. And obviously, at this point in his career, Terrence Stamp isn't going to do an impression of anybody. He's
no.
Terrence fucking Stamp. But somehow, cumulatively, it does feel like two halves of a whole. It's one of the better examples of that being done that I've seen lately, which winds up kind of being to the movie's detriment. But more on that in due time.
It is not a Silvio in Many Saints thing.
Right.
I guess we'll put it that way.
Back in the past, there's a scene that I rather liked where Sandy is once again hitting the dance floor, flirting listlessly, unenthusiastically with a slew of male clientele. Well, I should say I liked the scene up to a point. I liked it when she was, I think it's intercut, you know, in true Edgar Wright fashion, kind of frenetically cutting back and forth between her having these very formulaic icebreaker sort of conversations with her
Johns.
You know, "What's your name, love?" "Alex." "Oh, that's a lovely name." They all say the same thing. The first guy that she picks up, or the first guy who makes a pass at her, looks like Angus Scrimm. I mean, they made it as ghoulish as they possibly could.
Boy!
So that part I maybe could have done with that. But when she's on the dance floor, the song that's playing is Land of a Thousand Dances. And I thought that was clever just because you hear that song in any other context and you think, oh, this is kind of utopian. This is kind of, it sounds sort of heavenly. These Elysian fields where everyone is dancing forever. But in this hell that she's trapped in, it's like, oh, that sounds exhausting. A thousand dances.
One dance after another.
Yeah, right. Exactly. 1,000 dances in a row, 1,000 Johns in a row. That was maybe my favorite needle drop in the movie. And since it's an Edgar Wright movie, I have to point these things out.
Yes.
Back in the present, Ellie, who is coming apart at the seams at this point, is looking more and more frazzled, is opening up to John because she needs some kind of confidant. And he invites her to this Halloween party, and she goes, and she's trying to have a good time, trying to stay up late, trying to not sleep, because when she goes back to her place and sleeps, Sandy and her lived in the same apartment. I probably didn't mention that. It probably goes without saying. But so she,
yeah.
As far as she's concerned, I mean, we don't really know what to think. We know that she's maybe schizophrenic, maybe this, maybe that. But it seems like there's a haunting going on too. She seems to think that as long as she stays out of her own apartment and doesn't sleep there, everything will be hunky dory. This is the first moment where those boundaries start to get sort of eroded. She sees shadowy figures, men, you know, male silhouettes on the dance floor.
For the rest of the movie, essentially, she just gets endlessly pursued by the Moonlight Man.
Yes, by hordes of shadow people. And the first time you see them, they're a little more corporeal looking, and they've got these smooth, well, kind of bumpy, that is to say, featureless, fleshy faces that are sort of gross with these like pitted sockets with no eyes in them. and just sort of just a fleshy mound where their mouth should be. And that I kind of liked. But then, yeah, throughout the rest of the movie, they just turn into generic sleep paralysis demons.
Right.
Sort of smoky looking, sort of inky looking. And there's entirely too much of them. And I almost felt personally responsible in a way because I sent you the trailer for this movie when it originally dropped. And you were like, yeah, it looks good, but that shadow thing near the end kind of gives me pause. And I thought privately, I doubt I said as much, like, I'll bet that there's just like one, you know, it's a horror movie trailer. You got to throw some balls to the wall imagery in there. It's probably just a one-off thing.
You know, damn you, Matt.
I don't know why I thought that, because Edgar Wright isn't known for his restraint per se. I just kind of thought, yeah, it does look a little dopey. And I just gave the guy the benefit of the doubt. They're fucking everywhere. this movie is full to the tits with shadow men. And it's not very good. And the more you learn about the Shadow Men, the less good it is, which is to say, the worse it is. So she takes John back to her place. His name is a little fraught under the circumstances.
Yeah.
But he means no harm. He's a church mouse, just like her, very timid. And the two of them are canoodling. They're trying not to make any noise because the landlady doesn't take kindly to gentleman callers after a certain hour. And Ellie sees a mirror on the ceiling, not the first time she's seen it. It's no longer there in the present, but okay, at some point in the past, there was a ceiling-mounted mirror back when Sandy was meeting gentlemen callers of her own in this very room under more illicit circumstances. So in the mirror, Ellie sees Sandy being stabbed to death by her pimp, by Matt Smith, and she freaks out. That is to say, Ellie freaks out, and then John freaks out, and then the landlady freaks out. Landlady is banging on the door like a minotaur, just like going absolutely berserk. No men! Oh my god.
Banging on the door like Papa Bear in antlers.
Yeah. Yeah, true that. And Ellie is screaming, get off of her, get off of her. But, you know, screaming as though she were being attacked. And I sort of liked that schism. Again, it's not Freaky Friday. There's a little bit of a disconnect there.
And John doesn't really know how to take this. He's like, I'm not on her. I guess we're doing this all in the third person.
John's not on her. In all the flailing around in the dark, John shatters a mirror above a dresser, and then John McClane's over the broken glass on his way out of the room, and the landlady is like, we'll talk about this in the morning. They do talk about it in the morning. She says, you're lucky I didn't catch him. I would have killed him. And Ellie is her usual self.
I'm very sorry. I don't know what came over me. I just went.
I actually do like her performance. I just think that they probably did multiple takes, and
Edgar Wright just kept me, no, more.
Yeah, the most whispery takes
more
were consistently selected. Yet less. She goes to the library. She goes to the police, I think.
She goes to the cops first.
This was up till now the low point of the movie. It is later outdone by the climax. But she is just running down the streets, as per usual, getting menaced by shadow men. And the scene has some momentum. It's Edgar Wright, so it's cut together, you know, more than competently.
Propulsively.
Yeah, propulsively is a good word for it. But she's just not running anywhere in particular. She ultimately finds herself at a police station.
But that was not planned.
Yeah, but up until then, it's just,
she's running.
It's like if Repulsion was a Jason Statham movie. It's like, what am I watching? You know, like she's, I mean, it this movie does become more and more Repulsion, like the anti-sex, anti-man hysteria. And I don't want to sound like a right-winger when I say that. It's just the hysterical nature of her mania and all, you know, all the sinister, shadowy men assailing her at every turn.
Well, and there's
it's very
a stretch Polanski of the climax where it's like aggressively Repulsion, and yes, we'll get there.
Yeah, it's Polanski by way of, I don't know, I guess Edgar Wright, but it feels like beneath both of them in aggregate, or, you know, the combination doesn't really gel. So she goes to the police. She gives them this somewhat nutty testimony where she talks about these visions she's been having. One sympathetic lady cop takes pity on her and says that she'll do some investigating of her own. Allie goes off to do some investigating of her own. She goes to the campus library and is looking through old newspapers on microfilm.
Microfilm, microfiche.
Yeah. And she gets, this is the oldest cliche in the book, and I couldn't believe at first that Edgar Wright committed it, except then I realized there was a punchline attached, which I laughed at. No one else in the theater laughed.
To be fair, I think there was you, me, and two other people.
Fair enough. He comes up behind her, startles her. Oh, Jesus, John, why didn't you say anything? We're in a library. It's like, okay, fair enough.
Yep.
So she enlists his help. Will you look at this other crate of microfilm for me, please? And she gets up to, I don't know, stretch her legs, do something or other. And shadow men descend from all directions.
Dozens of shadow men.
Uh-huh.
She's running.
She grabs a pair of scissors. As soon as the scissors come out, you're like, oh, she's going to stab John, probably. Or she's going to stab somebody who didn't have it coming. Which is another trope that I could do without.
Turns out it was somebody who kind of had it coming.
Right.
Jocasta is in the library for some reason, and she gets within a quarter inch of Jocasta's face, and John stops her at the wrist. He grabs her wrist and stops her dead.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, with his other hand, takes the scissors. And this is an instance where Jocasta does the thing that she's done in every moment of her screen time, which is make it all about her.
Right.
And in this particular case, if it were anybody else, it's like, you have a beef. You were nearly stabbed in the face unprompted. But given what a fucking shit heel she is for the rest of the movie, you just want to say, shut the fuck up.
Right. Because
it's not about you.
She starts screaming her head off, security. So Ellie goes out onto the street. Movie's a bit of a muddle after this point, but she's again and again and again and again being tailed by shadow people led by Matt Smith. And there's one shot in particular that really provoked my ire, which is Matt Smith is effectively hiding behind an impossibly skinny lamppost.
I was just going to say, is it when like he comes Scooby-Doo, around the lamppost?
It's like a Scooby-Doo gag. I mean, that was good when Freddy Krueger did it, but that's in that movie, it's 80s camp, and I get that Edgar Wright has that in his blood and in his bones, but in those movies, the dreams and the reality were a little more clearly delineated. Here, it's just, it veers way too close to what we've complained about on this podcast any number of times in the past. The one that comes to mind for some reason is Death of Me, where it just all just kind of turns into porridge because the boundaries have completely disintegrated and what you're left with is not arresting enough or hasn't secured your interest enough for the filmmaker to get away with it. So she goes to the bar, not to mention
that like 80s Nightmare on Elm Street stylings and the giallo flavor of most of the movie, that is not a comfortable melange.
Perhaps not.
That does not taste good together. Anyway, continue.
Ellie goes to the bar where she works. She's an hour late, and Terrence Stamp is waiting for her. And she goes downstairs. He's queued up a song
called Eloise.
Called Eloise on the jukebox, and he starts monologuing at her most menacingly.
I used to know all the girls in this town.
And she says, I know what you did. She's recording him surreptitiously on her cell phone, expecting to wring a confession out of him, I guess. And everything he says is just dripping with sinister insinuations.
Well, except for one thing. And we elided a scene from mm-hmm. one of...
I know exactly the line you're thinking of.
Yeah, exactly. The John's sequence is eventually broken by a guy who, like, the conversation starts out again basically exactly the same, and then he breaks the cycle by pressing her, like, no, what's your actual name?
Mm-hmm.
And it's Sam Claflin, I think is the actor's name. Another unnecessarily handsome British man.
Kind of like vaguely Cillian Murphy looking dude, a little bit.
Cillian Murphy's weirder looking.
Yes,
more intense.
Uh-huh. Although this guy does give off an intense energy in his one scene. He, while seemingly looking out for Sandy's best interests, also manages to appear like a huge weirdo.
Anyway, he says, it's basically, you're better than this.
You're too good for this.
You're too good for this. Something. I think it's slightly more complicated than that. Then again, it might not be. Anyway, Terrence Stamp in this bar confrontation
mm-hmm.
after Ellie name drops Sandy specifically, says, yeah, I knew Sandy. I always told her she was too good for that life, or, right. or something to that effect. And like,
yeah, I don't remember Matt Smith ever saying that.
Yeah, he's not Jack. He's this probable vice cop.
Right.
And as it turns out, that's exactly who he is.
Yeah, because she pursues him out onto the street, is haranguing him, and this is when it becomes apparent that he's not who she took him to be. He stops in the middle of the street. The first time they ever have a meaningful interaction, she almost gets run over. So you can see this coming a mile away, too. Most of these twists and turns are too well telegraphed, I think. It's the classic, like, oh, watch where you're going, bitch, or whatever. And, you know, that's in the first act or thereabouts. And now here, he stops in the middle of the street, turns to get one last word in, and, of course, gets final destination.
And then Ellie's barmaid boss explains at length, no, that's so-and-so, ex-vice cop.
Yeah, right, tell the police he's an ex-cop, they'll come faster. And that's, you know, a relatively organic way to introduce that information. But
it is, but she, like, repeats it two or three fucking times.
That was abysmal. And her whole tone is like, oh, that sweet old man, he was a menace, clearly.
he was a pervert.
He had clearly done some sick, heinous shit in his day, just based on literally everything he said in both time periods, even in the past when he was sort of coming to Sandy's aid. As I said, he gives off Cillian Murphy energy. So, yeah, I don't buy the whole, like, oh, no, not Lawrence, or whatever.
Lindsay,
that's right. Ellie goes back to the apartment with John, and John is waiting outside. They rightly decide that the landlady doesn't want to lay eyes on him again. If I don't come back out in 15 minutes, maybe you'd better come and get me. Because she thinks she's going back into the lion's den, you know, that haunted room. She could get sucked back into the past. Who knows what could happen. Although we've already seen the murder play out at this point, I kind of figured the way this would happen is she would be body hopping into Anya Taylor-Joy, and then she would see, like, a retro news clipping about Soho socialite found murdered, and then it would be on her to prevent it. Mm-hmm. But we've already caught up with the moment of the death, and it was not fatal for Ellie. So the peril is a little bit murky at this point.
Yeah.
You know, like, if she did get sucked back into the past, what is there left to see at this point? Anyway, she never even makes it upstairs, so it's a moot point. She's talking in the parlor with the landlady, another twist that you can see coming a long ways off. Landlady says, oh, I have some of your mail here. It got mixed up with mine. Hands her a stack of envelopes. One of them is addressed to Alexandra something or other.
Collins.
Yeah, and this is
Mrs. Collins.
Alex or
Sandy.
Yeah, right. This is, well, it's Sandy's full name. And it was also the name that Sandy sometimes used with her Johns. So,
I mean, she used, like, all sorts of variations. She used Andy. She used Alex. She used Alexandra.
Right. In any case, you know, you look at that envelope and it's like, but the movie doesn't. Yeah, right. The movie does not appear to think so. The movie lets it sit. And things get very Mrs. Kirsch. The landlady sits down, offers her some tea. She drinks.
My father.
Yeah. My father worked for the circus. She drinks the tea like an idiot.
Like an absolute buffoon.
And we get another sinister monologue here. It's the landlady's turn to ham it up a little bit and talk about, oh, you know, there was a girl who was murdered upstairs. Yeah, she was Sandy. The death was a figurative rather than literal one. The flashback of the murder was, in fact, Matt Smith being stabbed to death, and he was not the last.
Maybe not the first.
Right. She slew just oodles and oodles of gentlemen callers and hid their bodies in the tenement, I guess.
And I guess Edgar Wright does lay the groundwork for this a little bit in terms of the smell. Because there's this bistro, as we mentioned, next door, and something about, like, do you like garlic? It's going to be all you could smell after a while.
Uh-huh.
And so apparently that covered up all of the rot.
Yeah, and I wouldn't put it past old Sandy to have brought in some extra garlic of her own just to seal up the crawl spaces with the lye or whatever.
So this twist is, it's hard for me to overstate my dissatisfaction. I'm going to table as much of that as I can until after the break. But everything goes tits up here. So obviously the drink is poisoned. Ellie retreats upstairs in a kind of drugged out, poisoned state. And John comes to the door and Sandy stabs John and then turns on Ellie. And as Sandy is pursuing Ellie up the stairs, she turns back into Anya Taylor-Joy, and the stairs turn into like CGI licorice. It's really it's sort of undulating. Everything looks flimsy and unreal, but certainly not in a way that feels retro. I mean, it looks like a Chips Ahoy commercial or something. I don't know quite how to put it, but it just looks fucking god awful. And you get shots of John surrounded by CGI smoke against just a black backdrop going, no! It's just dreck. So the two women, make it upstairs where a throng of shadow men are awaiting them. And in a different movie that had, I guess, less complex aspirations, obviously the shadow men would just get their just rewards. Sandy would get her comeuppance. But the movie, I guess to its credit, is trying to do something a little more complicated than that, but it's still kind of dead on arrival.
Yeah, it's still just nonsense.
There's a phone in the room that can only make emergency calls, a landline. This was established Chekhov's blank style in the very first scene in the apartment.
So after Ellie is grabbed and then held down on the bed by a series of just hands bursting through all surfaces, uh-huh, which is where the movie just turns into Repulsion for a second. Just a tackier giallo Repulsion.
Right. And none of this is practical, too. It's an extension of the CGI bilge that I was describing before. And I'm not one of those haters who's like all practical all the time or don't even bother. It just looks miserable. I don't know if you had the same reaction.
It wasn't great. And then finally, one of the Moonlight Men picks up this emergency line phone and is like, and then eventually you can make out,
help us.
And so at first you think like, oh no,
these poor martyred perverts.
Yeah, right. And then it turns on you again. They say, kill her, save us. And Ellie says, no. She's getting pulled in a lot of different directions. So Sandy makes it up to the room and sees the shadow men, I think.
They have faces.
Yeah.
At this point.
And their necks are all slashed. You can see their death wounds now. And she turns a little bit more maudlin, less malevolent. And, you know, I didn't want this life. And Ellie tries to console her. Sandy tries to slit her own throat. Ellie stops her. The building is going up in flames, by the way. I talked about CGI smoke and flames earlier. Didn't even think to mention why. What gets knocked over? A candle? Something.
Something gets knocked. The records burn first. Mrs. Yes. Collins, Sandy's records burn.
Not coincidentally.
Yeah.
Death to nostalgia, I guess. Which is a worthy enough message, but maybe one that Edgar Wright, of all people, is not equipped to make. So it's weird. Ellie saves Sandy's life, prevents her from killing herself, but then the whole building is just going up in smoke, and Sandy refuses to leave. So in effect, she does commit suicide. She elects to remain behind and burn, and Ellie can't do anything to prevent that, so the business with the attempted throat slashing feels totally pointless.
Yeah.
Ellie and John make it outside. He looked like he was really on his way out, but they both recuperate, and there's a happy-ish epilogue where it's her fashion show debut, her like runway debut. She's not a model, she's watching from the wings, and it's a big hit. It's 60s inflected fashion. So she hasn't completely moved on from the past, all of those shots of burning 60s memorabilia notwithstanding. Right. I guess she's expunged. And a picture of her mother goes up in the conflagration too, which is also maybe telling. Although she still sees Ghost Mom in this final scene.
A picture of her mom doesn't go up. It's just Sandy.
Though there's that in the parlor. I mean, in her room, there's a picture on the bedside table of Gran and mom that I thought she was going to retrieve, but then didn't.
I completely forgot that going up in flames. We saw the black and white photo of Anya Taylor-Joy at least half a dozen times.
Too many times. And the envelope again, for some reason.
Yeah, that's... As you'll recall, I remarked audibly when during the final montage of the whole place going up in smoke, it cuts back to this fucking envelope that says Ms. Alexandra Collins going up in flames. Like, we know who she is!
It reminded me of the latest Grudge flick, how it kept showing you the street sign for some reason. Do you remember that?
Yes! Oh my god. Bizarre. That was dumb.
So in this last scene, she sees her mother at first, again, mutely congratulating her on her success with minimalistic body language. And she turns around to talk to her grandmother, turns back around, and in the mirror, it is not her mother. It is, in fact, Sandy, young Sandy, who sort of waves at her. What are we to make of this? Yeah, you tell me. More after the break.
The lights are much brighter there. You can forget all your troubles, forget all your cares. So go downtown. Things will be great when you're downtown. No finer place for sure. Downtown. Everyone's waiting for you.
Hello, listeners. It's Jim, here as always during the break to tell you some stuff you probably already know. Please follow us on Twitter at ShockDoctorsPod, on Facebook at facebook.com/ShockDoctorsPod, or check us out on Apple Podcasts. The podcast is also available on Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. If you've got an idea for a movie you'd like us to check out, feel free to send us a DM on social media or email us at shockdoctorspod@gmail.com. And now, back to the show.
Everyone's waiting for me. Do you believe in ghosts?
And we're back. So right off the bat, just to issue a mea culpa on our behalf, ever since the moment relatively up front when we noted the three-color neon giallo shading, the Cornetto trilogy, there was a bug in my ear, like, no. One of those is not right.
We're not Brits. We did not grow up with Cornettos. They sound tasty, but I've never partaken of one. So Jim rightfully called me out on this.
Yeah, so there's no blue. Apparently it's green. So if it's not just the French flag, then it must be a three colors trilogy reference.
Yeah, I mean, I'm prepared to eat crow. Is that the expression?
Yes.
I'm prepared to eat crow on that one. I do still think it's funny. I'm glad that Edgar Wright isn't just getting high off his own farts with that. I do still think it's quintessential Wright for him to set
self-reference.
Just to put the room above a French bistro so that he can have three neon colors cycling and dip into the red when the horror kind of gets off the ground. He's a very go big or go home kind of filmmaker, so right. It suits his needs. And the ending of this movie does go big.
It made me want to go home.
And I went home. I can't remember. I liked Halloween Kills much less, and the ending of Halloween Kills is worse, but it's not like orders of magnitude worse.
It's not as damaging to the rest of the movie,
right?
By its relative badness, because the gulf between the ending of Halloween Kills and the rest of Halloween Kills is not as wide necessarily.
It's tripping on the bottom stair of the staircase, not tripping at the top of the staircase and falling all the way down, breaking every bone in your body. It gave me whiplash like nothing else in a long time. It reminded me of being 11 or 12 and just watching any shit bucket, you know, kind of PG-13, mid-2000s, late-90s thriller I could find on your AMC, your Bravo, whatever the hell, where, you know, there was just some inane twist would come along that would wreck absolutely everything that preceded it. I'm struggling to even think of an example. I mean, like, the twist in Identity is pretty out there, but like not awful for the kind of movie that is,
right?
But this is like in that wheelhouse, and it doesn't feel giallo. It doesn't feel like anything except like something I would have watched when I was a scaredy cat 11 or 12 year old, just because we all have to start somewhere, and I started with PG-13 horror movies with commercial breaks, you know, that, sure, that had been like edited for TV. And then if there was some totally fucking harebrained twist, I always found it sort of disappointing. I can't even think of a good example. I mean, I guess Identity is the best I can come up with. I'm talking about the movie from 2003 with the ensemble cast,
right?
James Mangold, I want to say, director.
Sounds plausible.
I'm just trying to distill a feeling more than one movie in particular, right, that made me feel this way. It really threw me for a loop. I got sucked into my own like Last Night in Soho wormhole, and not in a good way. I just never thought.
Flashed back to 12-year-old Matt.
Yeah, I'm not even like an Edgar Wright fanboy per se. I think he's done some really excellent work, but I still never imagined he'd do me dirty like this. I mean, the last 20-odd minutes of this movie are almost without merit. It's bad enough that Sandy, she has this conviction, and she's this, you know, it's a classic why won't anybody believe me narrative where she's got these mental problems.
You mean Ellie?
Yes, Ellie, yeah. Yes. Well, you know, doppelgangers, whatever,
sure,
duality.
Right.
Yeah, no, it is Ellie to whom I refer. She is wrong. I mean, she's just flat out wrong about the whole investigation. And she kind of gets this guy killed. And it doesn't matter that he wasn't an angel in my estimation, or, you know, couldn't have been, because it's Matt Smith and Terrence Stamp both being as villainous as possible with every minute of screen time that's afforded them. Still, it's, why would you make her such a buffoon? It like, that didn't sit right with me. And then everything that came after it was even worse. You know, why in stories like this are supposed to go, you know, no one believes her, but she's right. You know, if no one believes her and she's wrong,
it's like, then why do we care?
It just feels like such a slap in the face. And it does a lot to take the air out of the movie's sort of feminist posturing that she's just so misguided. And then everything to do with the revelation of who the real quote-unquote monster is, you know, with Sandy being this maniac and this multiple murderess, that further deflates the movie's feminism quotient. It just, like, totally, totally threw me for a loop, because prior to that, the movie was maybe not a masterpiece by any means, but a decent, occasionally better than decent, sort of feminist, revisionist, giallo meditation on this Me Too kind of milieu, you know, the entertainment industry exploiting young starlets. It's of the moment until it's retrograde in the worst possible way. And the horror of the climax, it's really hokey with the old lady, the landlady, going like, I'm gonna get you. She says that at some point. Maybe not those exact words, but she's...
Effectively those
she's
words.
Like Jack Torrance with a pension.
Danny boy!
And it's just, it turns into like a hush, hush, sweet Charlotte, whatever happened to baby Jane, what's the matter with Helen kind of like hag horror sort of thing. It's like, it's hush, hush, sweet Sandy. And that's not giallo. That's like something, I mean, there are giallo movies where an old lady did it. Deep Red being a famous example, spoilers for Profondo Rosso. But the way that it's presented here, it's way more Twilight of Betty Davis's career than anything that Argento would have ever done, you know?
Yeah. So When Matt and I were walking out of the movie theater, I attempted to quippily sum up my feelings on this movie in general. And what I said was, in the first half of the movie, I couldn't tell what the stakes were supposed to be. And in the second half of the movie, I realized, oh, the stakes are just dumb. Because the first half of the movie, it's like, okay, yeah, you know, maybe this girl is losing her mind, and that sucks and all, but fundamentally, it's not putting anyone's life at risk. If she is, in fact, flashing back to an actual murder victim, is she going to be able to stop it? It doesn't look like she has any control over anything.
No, and like I said, the murder itself happens at a weird point in the narrative where it feels premature.
And then, yeah, the second half, we just find out in succession, like, oh, well, she's going to bring Matt Smith to justice. It's like, oh, wait, Terrence Stamp isn't Matt Smith. Well, shit. And then it's, oh, well, this woman killed a bunch of Johns. But like, so we really care about these guys who are exploiting this young woman in order to use her body?
Uh-huh.
Okay, who cares? And then they're like, help us. And then we really, really don't care.
Oh, yeah.
And then...
No, when he lifted the phone off of the, you know, when he held up the emergency phone, I just thought, like, this is an emergency. I'm about to yell fire in a not especially crowded theater just to get this over with.
Well, I went into a fetal position.
Yeah, I remember that. Like, you assumed crash position, like on an airplane.
Oh, no.
Uh-huh.
Basically, what it amounts to is this woman who was forced into prostitution, killed a bunch of Johns, got away with it, lived out basically her entire life, and now set her own house on fire and stayed in it to die. It's just an elaborate suicide with some weird mental illness slash ghost stuff thrown in there for flavor. It's weird.
Well, and it's just, you know, the idea, their final moment of reconciliation is meant to be humanizing. And I guess on paper it is. The patriarchy made her a monster, but it just doesn't cut the mustard for me. I mean, 2 minutes prior, she's going like, rah, and just being like Mrs. Kirsch, you know. I mean, she is just like a banshee, a harpy, a complete mad woman. And it's just, it's trashy. It has nothing of value to say, at least in the back half, about, you know, the way that women in any profession or, you know, the entertainment industry, whatever, are chewed up and spat out. It just felt like I in the audience was being masticated, like I was being chewed up and spat out in the last 10-15 minutes before the credits mercifully rolled. I was really upset about it. And the one moment of merit that you could have introduced into the climax to make me feel something, it's the longest note I wrote for this movie. It's a like full sentence. I wrote, why hasn't she said anything she couldn't have known? Meaning, you know, they have this supernatural connection, this quantum leap thing going on. Why, after Ellie sees the writing on the wall and realizes that she's sitting across from Sandy, the woman whose body she's been hijacking in her dreams, why doesn't she say something like spookily specific that only Sandy would remember? And then Sandy could have this moment of realization, like, oh, you've been somehow vicariously experiencing the things I experience. Like, you know, make the moment special. Make something of the supernatural conceit that the whole movie is built on. It never comes up.
Well, they try and then they shunt it aggressively aside. Because Mrs. Collins, old Sandy, says something about this nice lady policewoman who comes by,
right,
and wants to do a wellness check on Ellie and relates this story of how a woman was murdered back in the past and she's having... apparently the cop told Mrs. Collins everything.
Right.
And so Mrs. Collins knows... Whether it'd be difficult to suspend her own disbelief is one thing, but fundamentally she knows this is what Ellie has been experiencing. And then Ellie, during this confrontation, I don't remember if it's during the poison tea stretch or in the flaming bedroom. I don't remember exactly where it is, but Ellie says something to the effect of, I know what you went through.
Uh-huh. But that's such
a Mrs. Collins almost literally bats that aside. She's like, no. It's like, okay, I was not literally forced into prostitution myself. I don't know firsthand, but I have the next best, or that is to say, the next worst thing. Having been basically body jacked into you while it was happening to you.
Along for the ride.
So it's like they wanted to have that moment that you're asking for, but then they just, like, stamped it out.
Yeah, right. They stabbed it with a knife and then set it on fire.
Well, and what I'm really asking for is something more, because, you know, when she says, you know, I know what you went through, that's kind of such a pat, vague sentiment. That could just mean I've been harmed, too, in similar ways. Like, I know it because I've lived it in this non-specific sort of way. I'm talking something more subjective, maybe something like a memory, I mean, a more subjective memory, something that might have triggered like a Proustian kind of thing on Sandy's end, where Ellie had maybe like described what Matt Smith's cologne smelled like. You know, that kind of, just make it personal, make it intimate. Just saying, I know what you went through is like something you say when you're trying to console a stranger.
Well, you know, I agree with that. I'm just saying it's as though they were building in that direction with the cop info dump session followed by I know what you went through. And it's like step three would have been he wore X cologne or whatever.
Right. Yeah, this is what he smelled like.
But instead it's just like, nope, Ellie has to spend the next 90 seconds dramatically dropping a teacup.
Right.
No time for pathos.
I wish to God that, you know, I sensed there was a twist coming because everything was just a little too simple. So I had a feeling that things were not going to be totally on the level. There was going to be some kind of a fucking curveball. And what I wanted to have happen, because the Vice Cops scene, the young Terrence Stamp scene, is wildly conspicuous because it's
his only appearance.
Yes. If he had just been lurking in the background of a couple different scenes and had a few minor interactions where, you know, Matt Smith was trying to get him off his back or something. Like, is that fucking Vice Cop here again? Let me pay him off or something. If it had been a little more low-key, then maybe they could have gotten away with doing what I wanted them to do, which I'm going to elaborate on in a moment. But as is, that scene does call attention to itself in a big, big way. And so it's no surprise at all that Terrence Stamp turns out to be that guy rather than
the law of economy of characters, yes, which we were talking about a couple episodes ago.
Yeah, right.
Same shit.
What I wanted to have happen in, you know, a different movie where the cop character was handled differently and more subtly integrated into things in the flashbacks would be to have Matt Smith, the pimp, be monstrous, but not be the killer, but to have Sandy be killed by this kind of pervy creep Vice Cop and have the story spill out a little bit and become woolier and more surprising in that way. Instead, it was almost the exact inverse of what I wanted to happen, where the cop was apparently not meant to be as ominous as I took him to be, which seems impossible given how he's portrayed in both time periods. I guess he was an angel among men or whatever the fuck. But I really wanted anyone other than Matt Smith to be the killer. It didn't really occur to me that Anya Taylor-Joy could turn out to be some kind of villainess. But as soon as they sat down with the tea and the Mrs. Kirsch stuff started to take off, my spirits
Mr.
sank.
Kirsch was my fodder.
He worked for the circus, yes. My spirits sank and like clanged against the floor of the theater like a ship's anchor. It was bad, bad, bad. Even the parts of the movie that are good are not quite as good as they could be. The murder scene when the mirror gets broken and there's the pounding on the door, you know, no men! At least you understand the violence of her reaction once you learn who she actually is. But yeah. So that is adequately prepared for. But still, the pounding on the door and the banshee scream is a bit much, a bit antlers, as you pointed out. But basically, I'm okay with that murder set piece, except for these sort of garish-looking shots of, and, you know, the movie is wall-to-wall with reflections, obviously. It's like the main motif where they're on opposite sides of glass, Ellie and Sandy.
And so if you're getting stabbed with a big knife, there must have been irresistible temptation to show a reflection in the knife, because reflections are what this movie is all about. I just wish that Edgar Wright had resisted that temptation, because it looks a little hokey.
Yeah.
The big scared eyes in the blade. It's not like what you'd get in an 80s De Palma movie, where it's a meticulously composed shot where the knife is angled just right to catch the victim's big scared eyes or whatever. It's just this kind of ugly looking computer composite kind of thing is a harbinger of how crappy the finale looks. And the special effects are not cheap looking. They just look like shit. I mean, they're just aesthetically not pleasing. And Edgar Wright usually has such a good eye that they become even more garish as a result when it's just Anya Taylor-Joy out in the town, or that big Thunderball marquee that I love so much, you know. And I do genuinely like that sequence a lot. It's so polished looking and so pristine. And then the climax and that element in the, you know, the knife, the reflection of on the knife in the murder. I hoped that thing with the knife and the reflection would be the most garish, ugly, out of place thing in the movie. And then
you were sorely mistaken.
Yeah, the climax just blew everything wide open.
It's kind of a shame that they give Mrs. Collins, older Sandy, so little to do except this god-awful climax, because it's Diana Rigg. Speaking of fucking James Bond marquees, she literally played James Bond's wife.
Right.
In the Lazenby
film. On Her Majesty's Secret Service, yes.
Right.
All the time in the world.
Yeah. And I believe she passed away recently, you know, COVID or something. So this might be her last film appearance.
That's devastating.
Yeah, all she really has to do is be a crotchety old lady for a couple of scattered scenes.
Yeah,
and
this,
then
like,
turn
sexless
into
old Harridan.
And then turn into a banshee.
Right.
And, you know, I don't know how they could have squared it if they brought her in more aggressively, because then that would probably have had us asking too many questions too early.
Uh-huh.
And everybody would have figured out that she was Sandy much earlier than Edgar Wright wanted them to. But I don't know. They did her dirty, I think.
Oh, very much so. I mean, they try to have it both ways, like I said, with her sort of having a moment of humanity and softness at the end, where the monstrous facade drops away and she laments the fact that she never wanted this life and she's been in prison for decades, in a matter of speaking. But it's too little, too late. I just think that Edgar Wright, on the basis of this climax, basically has not yet evinced the chops to bring that kind of dramatic heft to a horror moment that just isn't funny at all. I mean, I think that he obviously has a gift for comedy. That's self-evident. And
yeah,
he brings a certain amount of pathos and a certain amount of real peril to Shaun of the Dead. I mean, I think things get dicey in Shaun of the Dead near the end. It's why,
yes,
it's my favorite Edgar Wright movie, is because you actually start to feel the walls closing in on you in that movie in a way. And I'm not a zombie guy at all. So it's basically just Romero and Wright in that one movie and maybe a handful of other movies I could mention that actually give me that feeling where zombie cinema is concerned. So I hold Shaun of the Dead in very high regard. So I don't want to say that he can never pull this sort of thing off, but there are still fart jokes in Shaun of the Dead while all of that is happening. And here, something went awry. I don't know that it's necessarily his fault. I mean, he's director, co-writer, so I imagine it has to be. But I don't know what it is. He just seems to default to a sort of shallower, cheaper, hot fuzzier kind of. I mean, when she's chasing Ellie up the stairs and swinging the knife around, like, meh, rah, she looks like she's about to get gunned down by Simon Pegg in the third act of Hot Fuzz. Like, she's some random villager who's, like, out for his blood, and there's going to be some kind of action banter about, I don't know, because I'm
firing your gun into the air and yelling R.
Yeah, right. I'm not Edgar Wright, so I can't think up of a funny one-liner to say after you shoot an old lady, but because he's more talented than me, except in this one instance, you know, I'm really dismayed, just very dismayed. The mom stuff bothers me. Ghost mom bothers me. I'll tell you why. Thanks for asking. It comes up in the very first scene that we're introduced to Eloise. It's there sporadically when she's getting settled into the dorms, I think. Disappears for 90% of the movie, comes back at the very end. I don't know what I wanted from Ghost Mom. It just seems like a very in-your-face way of establishing that Ellie is not all there, you know? That she has some kind of mental malady that she's dealing with, and maybe life in the city is going to make her crack in this Repulsion kind of way. Obviously, Repulsion played its cards much closer to the chest, but be that as it may. The mom being such a focus of Ellie and the way she's characterized until the mom is basically supplanted by Anya Taylor-Joy, it's just puzzling. And then that literally happens at the end where Sandy supplants the mother. And I really can't see what that's trying to convey. There's nothing really for me to hold on to there. And the way that the mom is initially presented, you kind of think, like, okay, if Mike Flanagan was directing this, the mom would eventually get her out of a jam somehow. She'd be like, you know, the building is burning at the end, and the mom is like, quick, this way, and like leads her out a fire escape or, you know, something that would not have occurred to her.
Speaking of Moonlight Man.
Yeah. And I'm glad that, you know, that would have been too much of a Flanaganism. That's like my least favorite kind of stuff in Flanagan's movies. So I'm glad that they didn't go that way with it, but they kind of don't go any way with it. It's just there to tell you that Ellie's not entirely in her right mind. And I think that
We could have fucking figured that out.
Yes. Just based on how she fucking talks. You know, just based on how she behaves and based on the kinds of conversations she has with her grandmother before she leaves, the amount of worry that her grandmother is feeling about her
before she leaves
departure.
And then periodically in phone booths.
Yes, that's true. There's a lot of phone calls to Gran in this movie.
Well, mostly phone calls from Gran,
right,
to be fair.
Yes, where, you know, Gran is inquiring after her well-being. So it's very evident that Ellie is troubled, and if the mother ghost isn't going to factor into it, I don't know
why she's there.
Why she had to be quite that crazy. I mean, her meaning Ellie, why she had to be
constantly hallucinating.
Yeah, right. If it's meant to muddy the waters where the Soho flashbacks are concerned, it doesn't really, because they feel like horses of a different color. I mean, the Soho stuff is so fleshed out, and so, you know, and she wakes up with the hickey. It's just the movie doesn't, its heart is not in muddying the waters in that way. If that's what the mother is there for, then it wasn't worth it.
Nope.
I think I would still recommend this movie if the first half or two thirds had been really excellent, you know, and it would just be one of those missed opportunities. If it had been like studio meddling or something, if this was like the fucking Magnificent Ambersons, I would understand, you know, this would be one of those like butchered classics where it's like, yeah, the ending sucks, you know, like Red River or whatever, where, you know, no one likes the ending, but you live with it because the rest of the movie is so good. And even at its best, Last Night in Soho is just not quite there. So needless to say, I don't recommend it. The first half, I think I liked more than you did, and I think it was fairly close to being worth seeing, even if you didn't change the ending at all. I think that if you took out more of the shadow people and the first half was tightened in certain ways, the one moment that made me feel like, this is like a 7 out of 10, before it became like a 3 out of 10, was at the end of the first night in Soho, when Ellie is back in her room, and Sandy is back in her room, and the alarm is about to go off. They've been on opposite sides of mirrors all night long, sort of making eye contact with one another and communing across space and time. Well, just across time for the most part. They're both in Soho, obviously. And now Ellie, for the first time, is going over to touch Sandy, who's lying in bed asleep. And it just feels rushed, and that moment of contact doesn't have the oomph that it ought to have. It's cut to a song, like so many moments in Edgar Wright movies, and maybe that's why it plays out the way it does, because when you're trying to keep pace with a piece of music, your options are limited, you know? You have to hit all those beats, but I would have much rather just dropped the music out and let that moment breathe and given it more of a feeling of a connection being made, a little more magic. And instead, she just touches her and then wakes up and then rinse and repeat for much of the movie, where she's Unstuck in Time like Billy Pilgrim, and it's good, but not great, and it had to be great in order to make up for the things that are truly, truly bad. So, alas.
Yeah, I don't think I liked the front half of this movie as much less than you did as you might think.
Okay.
I liked it well enough.
It is well and truly eclipsed by the thing, the everything. Yeah, right. Yeah.
What bothered me a little bit about the front half is like, yeah, you know, I enjoyed just as a visual feast all of the first few nights in Soho, mm-hmm. 60s stuff. As you say, Edgar Wright has an obvious flair for staging set pieces, and it all looks good, and the giallo flavoring and coloring to it, it's all well and good, and I enjoyed it for what it was, but this is supposed to be a horror movie. This is not a case where, like, we decide we're watching this movie for our horror podcast, and now I'm just butthurt because it didn't end up fitting into that paradigm, and that's not the movie's fault. I think it is the movie's fault, or at the very least, if Edgar Wright had anything to do with the marketing of this movie, it's his fault, because it's supposed to be a horror movie, and the front half of it basically isn't. Like, right. It's that stretch, like, running through the backstage Requiem for a Dream sequence is horrifying,
yeah.
But it's horrifying in a Requiem for a Dream way. Requiem for a Dream is not a horror movie.
Well, not until the fridge sprouts teeth. That moment is scarier than anything in Last Night in Soho, even when it is
fair.
A true blue horror movie.
But, you know, 98% of that movie is just deeply unpleasant and horribly, horribly sad.
Yeah, harrowing.
And that's the closest that Last Night in Soho in the first half gets to being a horror movie. And then it does become a horror movie in the second half, but it comes like a hack.
Yes.
You should have left.
You know, I liked the back half of this movie less than like a bad David Coop movie. And I haven't seen Stir of Echoes, which is reportedly quite good, but I've seen, you know, Secret Window, You Should Have Left.
Stir of Echoes, I remembered thinking was all right, but I can't tell you a single fucking thing about it except that Kevin Bacon's in it.
Yeah, it's K-Bake. That's also the only thing I know.
So, I mean, it'll tell you something in terms of just how good it could possibly be.
Yeah, maybe so. No, I'm with you, and I think that the first half not being a horror movie could be deliberate in like a Trojan horse baited trap honeypot kind of way, where you have to buy into the fantasy in order for it to curdle and become this horrific,
whatever. I'm on board with that, except that I just didn't feel any undercurrent of something else.
Right.
And I feel like there needed to be like just a little bit of menacing flavor to it.
Yes.
And I mean, you get a little of that with Terrence Stamp looming
a little bit
periodically, but only a very little bit,
a faint wisp.
And it's not enough.
I mean, the moment that I harped on about we're wishing that her touching Sandy's shoulder while she's asleep, wishing that moment had been more protracted. That's just one example of how the first half of this movie could have and should have found suspense, even in the isn't this all a wonderful party kind of part of the 60s Soho flashbacks. You know, I think that
the first thing I thought of when you said that is great party, isn't it?
Yeah, great party, isn't it? Yeah, right, exactly.
Just a blood covered overlook guest.
I've always wanted to go to a Halloween party dressed up as that ghoul in particular with the bloody seam running down the middle of his face. I've never gone above and beyond for Halloween that way with like
makeup.
Yeah, right, exactly. Like movie makeup, you know, with modeling clay and whatever. But
yeah,
maybe someday. I just can't get over Terrence Stamp dying because he didn't pass Ellie's vibe check. That's so fucking stupid.
Really, really not good.
And John should have been a person. He's basically not a person. He's just a wafer thin nice guy who has like no bad qualities of any kind and is only there to be helpful.
Yeah, although that might be marginally less irritating given the context of the rest of the movie than a wafer thin fake nice guy.
Right.
Like, that would have just been a bridge too far. That would have been too much.
Yeah, it would have taken the misandry to the next level. Well, I just, you know...
But yeah, I completely agree. He needed to have more to him.
He's just... it feels like a waste of the talents. I didn't recognize the actor as a black guy. It felt like a little bit, I don't think this is a word, tokenistic, in a way that I couldn't really pin down, to have him be the love interest, but to give him, like, absolutely nothing to chew on, you know, like, actor-wise, no defining personality traits, no nothing. Again, he's just there to be of use in the investigation and to very gently, very, very gently woo the heroine. I guess, you know, obviously the business with the shadows, it's so repulsion-y and so... Please believe me when I say that I only ever invoke this word ironically, you know, so like misandrist, you know, so man-hating, that, yeah, making him also a heel would have been, as you said, a bridge too far. But in a better horror movie, you know, like in Carnival of Souls, for example, you've got the creep who's always kind of trying to hound the main lady and sort of strong arm her and badger her and getting pissy when she won't put out. And I just think that's how you do a repulsion. You know, you do it with microaggressions, not right. with these, like, cranked up to 11 armies of shadow devils, you know? I don't know. Even like, Black Swan, which is a movie that I think is fairly unsubtle and kind of rubs my feathers the wrong way, punnily enough, is understands that, at least, that it's a death by a thousand cuts. When your female protagonist is a repulsion knockoff. Is it Catherine Deneuve? Who is it in that movie?
Yeah.
Is like a Catherine Deneuve alike who is slowly but surely coming apart at the seams. It's one little slight and one little scare after another, and it builds and builds and builds. In this movie, it's just once the shadow people show up, it's like all bets are off. It's just nonsense. So I recommend... obviously, that you watch Repulsion. I think one or both of us have recommended it in the past.
Yeah, I think we have.
Watch Black Swan. Watch Deep Red. Yeah, no, watch Deep Red. That's my formal recommendation. That's the one where an old lady did it. But it's done with much more panache. There's a great, almost in a league of its own, great bit of blink and you miss it foreshadowing, where the movie shows you who the killer is, but in a way that you're not likely to notice on a first viewing. I noticed it, I think, on my third viewing, and my head spun around 180 degrees multiple times and steam came out of my ears. You and I were watching it on that viewing, actually, and I waited until the end of the movie so as not to spoil things. Not like giallo whodunits are, they're not really about the twist, but even still, the twist is part of the fun. I waited until after the movie, and then I demanded that you wind it back so I could confirm that I wasn't seeing things, and I wasn't. It's like,
oh, holy shit.
It's this incredible, like, Where's Waldo sort of moment, and it does factor into the plot. The character in that movie who's trying to solve the crime has this unshakable, sneaking feeling that he saw the killer's face, or that he saw... I think he keeps thinking that he saw a painting hanging on the wall of the apartment where the murder was committed. And then when he goes back to the crime scene, the painting is not there. Turns out it wasn't a painting he saw. It was the killer, like, lurking in the shadows. And it was their face. And it's so eerie. It's not my favorite Dario Argento movie, or I think I like opera more. I mean, I certainly like Suspiria more. That's his masterpiece, but it's quite good, and an old lady did it. So there you go.
Bingo.
Bingo.
So I have a couple recommendations. One movie is one I think I've recommended before, but frankly, at this point, we've been doing formal recommendations for over 50 episodes, over half the podcast. I don't feel bad about cycling back through on occasion. The movie is The Neon Demon, a Nick Refn movie from 2016.
I still haven't seen it, and I know you die a little inside every time I say that.
Every time. It is about the fashion industry, which is related more directly to Ellie, obviously, than Sandy, who wanted to be a singer. But still, similar level of cutthroat, I think, in both industries. Neon Demon is about the models rather than the designers. But Elle Fanning plays this farm girl, essentially, like, you know, off the bus from Iowa or wherever, comes to L.A. and just gets chewed up and spit out by the industry and by these more experienced models. And there's a lot of gooshy gore into it. It's very grim. It's very Nick Reffin. If you've seen any of his movies, you'll kind of know what to expect. It is also true to the title, very neon, and in that way has some giallo flavoring to it, although it tends to be a cooler neon than, you know, like bright reds and yellows, more blues and greens, but still somewhat of a similar vibe there. And I like Neon Demon quite a bit, which is probably why I'm recommending it for the second time and waiting desperately for Matt to watch the film. I'm also going to recommend another movie, which is not a horror movie, but which does have a thematic connection to Last Night in Soho, in that it is about singers. It's about how the industry will, again, to recycle this phrase once more, will chew you up and spit you out.
Uh-huh.
It's called Teen Spirit. It also, incidentally, I guess I'm just on an Elle Fanning kick today. It stars Elle Fanning. She enters this, it's like an American Idol sort of competition. It might be called Teen Spirit, or that might just be the title of the movie. Either way, she enters this, and then she goes through the classic, there's a lot of drugs involved and this and that. There's also a lot of neon in this movie, incidentally. Neon all over. I like neon, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't know. And like I said, this is definitely not a horror movie, but I like it a lot. It also has Elle Fanning doing a cover of Dancing on My Own, which I might like better than the original.
It's good. It's a good cover.
So, yeah, I would check both of those out. And also all of the movies that Matt rattled off, frankly. In any case, I think we can put Ellie to bed now, and hopefully she won't wake up in Soho once again.
Yes.
But until next time, I'm Jim Smith.
Yep. Okay, yep. Downtown is not stuck in my head anymore. It was when we started recording. I was not planning to end this way. I just did a little self-interrogation. It was, you know, going, gone. I'm Matt Gerandese.
And we're the Shock Doctors. We will see you next time. As always, we have some acknowledgments. Our music was composed by Will Connor. Audio for the bumpers was taken from Last Night in Soho official teaser trailer HD in theaters October, uploaded by Focus Features. All rights reserved. Our next episode will be up on Sunday, November 28th, and we will be discussing Paranormal Activity Next of Kin, which is, dear God, the 7th installment in the Paranormal Activity series. See you then.